What John asked me to cover today, and we had a delightful trip up, stayed last night at the Chauvin's, and just a really, really nice evening. I'm looking forward to this. He asked me to cover Daniel chapter 8, chapter 10, and 11. So as I sorted through the chapters, I decided that we would go through 8 and 11 because they do have a connection as we proceed in the Bible study, and then the sermon will actually be about chapter 10, because there's another lesson above and beyond the understanding of some detailed prophecies that we'll find there. So if you'll open to chapter 8, in the year, a third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me. Now, Belshazzar was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, and he was reigning at the time that Daniel saw the vision of the handwriting on the wall. Remember that vision written earlier and covered earlier, another chapter. And that was the night Belshazzar died, because when Daniel saw that vision and gave him the interpretation of it, that was the final day of the Babylonian Empire, because the Persians came. They had diverted the water of the Euphrates River, which flowed under the gates or under the wall of Babylon and out the other side. They managed to divert it enough that they could run their army in the night under the wall, and then it was all over. They overran the place. Belshazzar died. Even though Daniel had made him third in the kingdom, it was a short promotion. However, as was the case with most of the empires in the ancient world, you didn't just slaughter all the officials, because they knew how to do stuff. If you didn't want to desolate a city, then you kept those officials that knew how to run things, that echelon. And Daniel was part of that, very much a part of that. So he went from working for the descendants of Nebuchadnezzar, even as he had served Nebuchadnezzar initially, to working with the Persians, the Medes and the Persians. And initially he worked, and we will see him working with Darius. Darius was a Mede, and that's M-E-D-E rather than M-E-A-D. Darius was a Mede, which meant that he came from the area between the Caspian and the Black Seas. We have a map, and you'll see where this is all. That was mostly the Medes up around the Caspian, either actually a little bit on either side. Many Israelites were settled up there, by the way. When the 10 tribes were taken captive by the Assyrians, Assyria controlled that area of the world, and they dumped a lot of the Israelites in the cities of the Medes. Well, these were Medes, and that may have been some Israelite mercenaries involved in the battle against Babylon. That's entirely possible, because that was how the nations worked. They recruited mercenaries from their captured peoples. Darius was a governor of Babylon. Babylon was no longer the capital of the empire. It was another city. In fact, they actually had two or three capitals, and some of them were seasonal. So in the wintertime, you went where it was warm to rule, and summertime, you went where it was cool to rule. So usually higher, lower elevations. The emperor was Cyrus the Persian, and he was named and prophesied by Isaiah 150 years earlier. By name, it was going to be Cyrus that would be God's anointed, as it were, to release the Jews from their captivity and send them back to Jerusalem. And in 539 B.C., Cyrus took Babylon. His armies did, and then he released the Jews that year. And then nearly 50,000 of them made their initial pilgrimage back, established a settlement in Jerusalem and in the surrounding areas, and then gradually more came. And that's a critical time in the resettling of Judea, as well as elements of what would have been northern Israel. So we have, backing up, third year of the reign of Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, to Daniel, after one that appeared to me the first time. And I saw in the vision, and it so it happened while I was looking, that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. That would be east of Babylon. And I was by the River Ulai. And River Ulai actually was an irrigation canal that had been cut out of the Tigris. And I lifted, was it the Tigris or Euphrates? Well, it was one of them. So that's a joke. If you know Mesopotamia, they are the big rivers there. And I lifted my eyes and I saw there standing beside the river a ram which had two horns. So we have a ram picture. A ram has two horns, as you can see if my magic pointer works. There you go. Most rams do. I was just noting that in one of the commentaries that the Persian kings, instead of wearing a crown into battle, they wore a helmet that looked like a ram's head. In other words, it had horns. Now, whether they had the horns on them or they were probably embossed in the bronze, that's what I suspect, because that would be safer. Just this past week, an archaeological article appeared in, which magazine was that? Either WorldNet Daily or else it was Christianity Today. No, sorry, it was USA Today. That's where it was. And it was a warrior that had been excavated in the area east of the Caspian Sea not long ago. And it showed helmets that they had excavated with it. He had quite a stash of stuff, so he was probably a warrior king. But his helmet, the ceremonial helmet is what they thought it was, had ram's horns embossed in the helmet. So that seems to be a symbol of, even in that way, of Persia and anybody that was serving with Persia in that sense. Thus, potentially had been a mercenary. They figure he was dated back 2,200 years ago, so it would have been a couple hundred years after the time of Daniel, but it would have been about the time of the Medes and the Persians, especially at this time of the Persians. So there we have the Persians described as that. Let's go on with the story. There was a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. Now, I don't know if they depicted this. I guess they did. This horn is the small one. This one's a little bit bigger, not just because it's on the side that we're on. And the reason why one horn was higher is because the Persians were the dominant partners in the Medo-Persian Empire. That's why. I don't know why it was called Medo-Persian. It should have been the Perdo-Median Empire. The Persians were the dominant force by far. The Medes were their lieutenants. Darius the Mede, who was the governor of Babylon, and that's with whom Daniel worked in his old age, was a governor. He wasn't the emperor. The emperor was Cyrus. So that one horn was bigger than the other horn, symbolizing that one part of the partnership was more powerful than the other. And the higher one came up last, and I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver him from his hand. But he did according to his will, and he became great. He did whatever he wanted. He had the power to do that. And then while I was considering, so he's looking at this ram standing out there pushing this direction and that direction. From the west across the surface of the whole earth, without touching the ground, this goat came. That means he came quickly, obviously, without touching the ground. And he had a notable horn between his eyes. So he was be more like what we would call a unicorn. You know, and whether there were actual unicorns, that's questionable. You know, this one would be a unicorn, but he's a goat. Most unicorns are thought to be horses. And in fact, in the King James, if you have a King James translation, you'll see the horns of the unicorn in Deuteronomy. Let me see, what is that? It's chapter 33, yes. Ephraim and Manasseh will push the people together with the horns of the unicorn. That's the way the King James reads. And you thought, like, well, hold it. Horns, plural, of the unicorn, singular. Unicorn means one horn. So why are you calling it horns? Well, then you lo and you find out the Hebrew word that they were translating into unicorn is Reem, which is R-E-E-M-S in English letters, means wild oxen. So, in fact, the unicorn was technically a wild ox in some of the places where it appears in the King James. But other times it's more of the goat. Even on the British national emblem, shield, it looks more like a goat. Anyway, we go along, we read this. He came at the ram, had two horns, and I was standing beside the river, and the ram and ran at him with furious power, and I saw him confronting the ram, and he moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns, and there was no power to the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore, the male goat grew very great, and when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable horns came up toward the four winds of heaven. So we have, there we go. This is a tamer-looking goat. He looks rather sheepish to me. But that was the image that I found on Google, so I thought, well, okay. Here we have the four notable horns. Please ignore Rome, as Rome we'll talk about later. Macedonia, which is where Alexander the Great came from, and by the way, that's who that goat was, that with the big horn. That was Alexander's empire, Alexander's army, charging across Asia Minor and smashing into the center of Persia. And they destroyed Persia as an empire in less than 2 years of campaigning. They had completely overrun the Persian Empire and made it the Grecian Empire or the Greco-Macedonian Empire. Thrace would have been over in the area of Asia Minor on the edge. Syria, where Syria is today, was where Syria was then, north of Israel. And that was the western or the eastern part of Asia Minor and further toward Mesopotamia. That was going to be governed by the Seleucids. And then the branch down in Egypt was governed by a general of Alexander's named Ptolemy. So that was the Ptolemaic Empire down there, P-T-O-L-E-M-I-A-C, something like that. The Seleucids were named after General Seleucid, or Seleucus was his name. He tried to hold the empire together initially after Alexander died in 332 B.C. He tried to hold it together. It didn't hold together, and so it broke into these parts dominated by various generals. Cassander was the general in Macedonia and Greece. In Thrace, which was, as I said, the western edge of Asia Minor, that was Lysimachus. And then the Seleucids was the bulk of the northern area north of Israel and off toward the Euphrates River. That was the Seleucid Empire. And then the Egyptian element was the Ptolemies, or Ptolemies, if we're Americans and we like to say the P. That's like getting pneumonia. Now, for all practical purposes, these two horns drop out of sight, and we don't have to worry about those. The power resided in Syria and Egypt. And for the next couple of hundred years, these two elements of Alexander's empire are going to fight back and forth and back and forth. And that's what we'll cover here in Daniel 8 and then in Daniel 11 as well. Then the Romans will come into play. Ultimately, the Romans will take Egypt, and they'll become, in Egypt we will read as the king of the south, the Ptolemies in the prophecy, the historical part of it. And Syria would be the king of the north. And you think, well, why are they called north and south? Well, because in the Bible, Syria is north of Jerusalem, and Egypt is south. In almost all directions in Scripture, unless specifically noted, are oriented to where Jerusalem is. If somebody is someplace else and then they go north, well, obviously that's specifically noted. They're going north of wherever they were. But if it's just a direction dropped, It typically means it's either north, south, east, or west of Jerusalem, which is the focal point of the earth in that sense. So this branch of Alexander's empire became the king of the north. This branch down in Egypt was the king of the south. Now, that will have implications as we move forward. Obviously, the power of Rome overtook the king of the north, and he became the king of the north. They controlled the king of the south. They overran him too. But Rome was north of Jerusalem, even though it was north and west. And by taking over the king of the north's domain, then eventually Rome inherited that status or that title as well. Okay, where were we? We'll read through this. The goat grew very great. He became strong. The large horn was broken. Four notable ones came up to the four winds of heaven. And out of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. That will be Antiochus Epiphanes. We'll read about him in chapter 11, so we'll look at his picture then. He's just looks like a regular guy on a coin. And not as handsome as that fellow on the buffalo nickel was years ago. Anyway, he would grow great toward the, where was that? Toward the north, toward the south. He pushed at the Ptolemaic Empire, and sometimes Antiochus actually conquered the Ptolemaic Empire, and the Romans took it away from him, which was very disappointing and made him quite put out. So that when he went back home through the Promised Land, he massacred thousands and thousands of Jewish people and looted the temple. And that didn't satisfy his rage because he came back, and we'll get into that later. So toward the east and toward the glorious land, and it grew up out of to the host of heaven. It cast down some of the host and the stars of the ground and trampled them. Now, that references, well, that sounds the stars, the hosts. That sounds like angels. How could he cast down angels if he's just a regular human king? And the answer is he can't. God made a prophecy in Deuteronomy that the Israelites would also be like the stars in the heavens for the numbers. So sometimes there is a human application of that phrase. And they are also called in Exodus the hosts of the eternal, meaning the armies of Israel. By that, the army, I mean the whole nation. Moving out of Egypt, we're called the host, the Lord's hosts. So the application of those titles isn't always for angels. Most of the time it is. In this case, it is a reference to the Jews, because they were the ones that he struck down. They were the ones following God's law in the world at the time, the ones there in Jerusalem. And we go, and he trampled on them in that sense, desecrated the temple, and Daniel 11 gets into that. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. And by him, the daily sacrifices were taken away. He elevated himself to be like he was God. He was a forerunner of what the Roman emperors would all do, you know, in his attitude. And it's not surprising, because this fellow called Antiochus Epiphanes, and his last name or first name is Anti, A-N-T-I, O-C-U-S is good enough. Epiphanes is the Greek word for God manifests, or, you know, you have an epiphany. Suddenly God brought something to your mind. E-P-I-P-H-A-N-E-S. E-P-I-P-H-A-N-E-S, as far as I can tell. Except the Jews had another name for him. They didn't call him Antiochus Epiphanes. They had no love for this man. At least most of them didn't. They called him Antiochus Epimanes. They did a word play on Epiphanes, the Greek word play, and changed it to Epimanes, which means madman. They called him Antiochus the Madman. In historical references, he is called Antiochus the Fourth. That was a popular name among the Seleucids. But he was always had the added title that he chose, which was Epiphanes, added to it. Okay, so we pick it up again. He exalted himself as high as a prince of hosts. He acted like he was God, very self-absorbed. He stopped the daily sacrifices. He took those away. And the place of his sanctuary was cast down. He looted the temple. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifice, and he cast truth to the ground, and he did all this and prospered. So he destroyed in his time a great deal of a great number of people in Judea, and destroyed a lot of the temple furnishings and things, and looted them, took them. Some of those perhaps were recovered later, but most of them had to be rebuilt. So he was not a good man by any means. And Alexander had been honorable compared to some of the ones that ended up following him. Now, to give you a perspective of Antiochus, he ruled from 175 to 164 B.C., 175 to 164 B.C. So Alexander died in 332 or 333 B.C. So this is like 150-some or 175 years later is when Antiochus Epiphanes showed up. So in the prophecy, we move from Alexander's death, the four generals that had their four smaller empires, and none of them had the power that Alexander had. And then ultimately you jump forward nearly two centuries, over a century and a half at least, and you come to this little horn, which in this picture they call it Rome, but we don't think it applies to Rome. That was in one interpretation. It far more accurately applies to this particular leader that there was. Anyway, here's the Persian Empire to give you a perspective. Jerusalem would be right there. And the Persians ruled part of Macedonia for a time. They controlled Egypt. They went all the way to India and up into Bactria, as this is called. Afghanistan is over in here. Parthia was ruled by the Persians. Parthia later was to break loose and become their own empire, but not yet, not at this time. This is what Alexander destroyed. And then Alexander's empire looked, oh boy, out of focus. Well, if you'll note, the territories are roughly the same. The conquest of Alexander the Great, I have no idea why it's so fuzzy. But the territory and the land area, except at Greece, if you'll note over there, where the Persians just had a little bit of Macedonia, Alexander obviously had all of Greece. So we'll go back. That's much nicer. Just imagine that the blue comes down through there. And otherwise, he just took over the empire. You know, just one had one emperor, and then it had another one after the wars were over. Then I heard a holy one speaking in verse 13, and another holy one, and that said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation and the giving of the sanctuary, both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? How long will this horrible thing happen? And he said to me, 2,300 days. 2,300 days, and the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Now, if you note, the word days in the New King James has a marginal rendering. It literally is translated from the Hebrew as, let me see, where is it translated, the Hebrew? No, it's down here. Ereb Boker. Ereb Boker. E-R-E-B is the first word in English letters. This is the Hebrew. It's a phrase, actually, two words. And the second word is B-O-Q-E-R. Boker. And Boker is morning. Ereb is evening. Evening, morning. Now, counting from sundown to sundown, there was a term that some say, well, that means day, because that's 24 hours, evening and morning. So that was one interpretation, is that it would be 2,300 actual days, or 2,300, or is it 2,300 evenings and mornings? We believe that it applies to the evenings and mornings, and that makes it 3 years and 55 days long that the sacrifices were stopped at that time. Now, if we go back and look at why, the preponderance of the evidence seems to favor the interpretation of 1,150 days. The context speaks of the suspension of the Tamid. The Tamid, T-A-M-I-D, in English letters for the Hebrew word, means sacrifice or sacrifices. It is a reference to the Olat Tamid, and that you just put a little word in front of Tamid, O-L-A-T, which means continual burnt offering, which the priests were commanded by God to maintain, a continual burnt offering, evening and morning. There was a morning sacrifice, and there was an evening sacrifice every day. So the sacrifices, you know, continued on and as a unit in that sense. Thus, looking at the evening and morning, we see the evening and morning being separate sacrifices. Thus, the days are actually evening mornings. 2,300 evening mornings or 1,150 days, 3 years and 55 days technically would amount to that. Now, from the time that Antiochus desecrated the temple, and we get into more detail of that in chapter 11, that was in 168 B.C. From the time in 168 until the cleansing and rededication by the Maccabees. We'll talk about the Maccabees for a minute. When Antiochus began to overrun and destroy Judea, and then he got so angry that he offered swine's blood on the altar of burnt offering, or sacrificed swine. He set up a statue of Zeus in the temple, and then he made a law against the sacrifices being offered, the Mosaic sacrifices, and against any of the Mosaic law being observed, and made that punishable by probably death because he was so angry. The Maccabees were a priestly family, a Hasmonid family. And the father's name was Jonathan, I believe, Jonathan Maccabees. He had five sons. They started a guerrilla war against the Greek forces of the Seleucids, the Greek Syrian Greek forces. And after 3 years, they had prevailed. They had driven Antiochus's people out, and they reconsecrated the tabernacle or the temple. And got the sacrifices going again. The Jews celebrate that event, the beginning of sacrifices and the cleansing of the temple, with their annual holiday of Hanukkah. It's a commemoration of the events that happened at that time. So the 2,300 days have that application in history. There are some indications, though, that this will happen. This will be applied into the future. Let's go on in verse 15 now of chapter 8. Then it happened when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was speaking the meaning, and suddenly there stood beside me one having the appearance of a man, and I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Uli, who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So once again, Daniel meets with Gabriel. He had already met Gabriel earlier. And Gabriel made this man understand the vision, so he came near where I stood. And Gabriel is an angel, by the way. And when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. And he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. Now, then that suddenly throws a new significance to the sacrifices being cut off. And then being reinstated and then cut off, because there are references to that. So there is a future fulfillment. We anticipate that at some point the Jewish Kohens, that's the Hebrew word for, well, actually, technically, the Hebrew word would be Kohoim. They don't put an S for a plural on the end of Hebrew. It's the I-M sound. The Hebrew priests, they know who the priests are those who are Orthodox Jews. They know who the priestly families are. They have always. They've maintained the very careful record of that. So at some point it is anticipated that the priest would begin to offer sacrifices on the Temple Mount. Now that's going to cause no small stir. Some think that there has to be a temple built, and maybe there does. I'm not sure that the temple has to be rebuilt for that, because the sacrifices can be offered. They were offered outdoors. The altar of burnt offerings was outside of the temple. It wasn't in the temple. So it's possible that they could actually begin sacrifices without a temple, but it would be in the environs, within yards of the Dome of the Rock, which is the third most holy site of Islam. So you can see the dynamics that would suddenly come into play in an application of this in the time of the end. So we will wait and see as how that unfolds exactly, but it has an application for our day ahead of us. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face on the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright. You imagine Daniel going through this. He was awestruck by this vision. And it's not surprising. Ezekiel reacted very similarly. So did Isaiah, and so did the Apostle John. They were completely shattered. I am undone, Isaiah said, when he saw the vision of God's throne and then the angels coming and going and the ones talking with him. So he touched me and he stood me upright and he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be. And the ram that you saw having two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn between its eyes is the first king. And the broken horn that the four that stood up in its place are the four kingdoms that will arise out of it, but they will not have its power. We already covered that. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressions have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully and prosper and thrive, and he shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. That was fulfilled by Antiochus Epiphanes about 150-plus years later. There's a really detailed prophecies that Daniel is giving, and we have the historical records to show that exactly what the prophecies he was made to write down have come to pass. In the book, or in the chapter 11 itself, all by itself, there are over 100 historically fulfilled prophecies that Daniel was inspired to write down hundreds of years before they occurred, and they've all occurred. Again, it shows God's hand in the world of man. And through his cunning, and that's the way that Antiochus operated, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule. One of the things that he did, he moved in, invaded Galilee, he took the wealth from the rich people and gave it to the poor people and drew then behind him a sort of fanatical local population. He then went down and he ousted the high priest, Onias was his name, and in his place he put his brother, whose name was Jonathan, and he immediately changed his name to Jason, which is the Greek form of Jonathan. He wanted everything to be Hellenized or made to be like the Greeks. And so Jason pretty much followed that. Then later, 3 years later, he sold out through intrigues. Antiochus sold out the high priest was actually ruling the country at the time. The line of David was gone. It was not on the throne there. It was governing another part of Israel. So about 3 years after he made Jason the high priest, a quasi-Jew named Menelaus bought that privilege. He outbid Jason, and so he was made to be the high priest. And the dynamics were getting worse because when Antiochus attacked Ptolemy to the south, there in Egypt, Jason led the people in a battle against Menelaus and threw him out. Menelaus had to run for his life. When Antiochus found that out on his return back to Syria, after the Romans had he conquered Egypt, and then the Romans said, no, you can't have it. Get out of here, or we will destroy you. And he had no power to fight Rome. So he did have power to fight the Jews. And he came back through the Promised Land, going north now, back to his home. He killed Jason and killed thousands of Jews and reinstalled Menelaus. And then, well, we'll get into more of that story later. And then ultimately the Maccabees began the revolt that threw him out of the promised land entirely. Okay. So he will cause deceit to prosper under his rule because he was deceitful. He will exalt himself in his heart. He will destroy many in their prosperity. He will even rise against the prince of princes and be broken without human means. He came to nothing. Ultimately, Antiochus, it came to nothing. And the vision of the evening mornings, which was told is true, therefore seal up the vision, which refers to many days in the future. And Daniel promptly fainted. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days afterward. I rose and went out to the king's business, and I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. So we have this amazing developments taking place, but it has to do with the remnant of Alexander's empire fighting between the horns, between Egypt and Syria, and ultimately Rome then beginning to intervene. Now we're going to go into chapter 11 and cover as much of chapter 11 as we can. I may have to save a little bit for the sermon itself. And when I cover chapter 10, so chapter 11 begins in the first year of Darius the Mede. That would be 539. It was right after Babylon was conquered. He was also known in history as Gubaru, G-U-B-A-R-U, Gubaru. Darius was his regal name, or his name while acting governor, his title, in many, more like a title. The kings of England, the queens of England, all take a throne name. It isn't always their given name. Sometimes it is, but not always. For instance, Queen Elizabeth's father was named Bertie, Albert. But when he became king, he chose to be King George. He took on one of the George name. And I think it was George the Fifth or George the Sixth. So likewise, Darius would have had a name besides his regular name that he was also known in history at. So we go on in verse 1, that I, meaning that from chapter 10, that is an angel, because Daniel is being talked to by an angel in chapter 10. And we're saving that because there's a whole other fascinating story, saving that for the sermon. So it's an angel that is talking to Daniel, telling him all these things. I stood up to confirm and strengthen him, Darius the Mede, and we'll find out how the angel, probably it was Gabriel, because that's the one that Daniel talked to the most, was strengthening Darius. We'll find that out. And now in verse 2, the third year of Cyrus, again 536, I, God's angel, will tell you, that's Daniel, the truth. Behold, three more kings, that is after Cyrus, will arise in Persia. Three more powerful kings. There were other kings, of course, but there were three particular ones. One was Cambyses, who was the son of Cyrus, and then Pseudo-Smerdis, I'll give you some dates if you like dates. 530 to 522. Remember, we're counting down because it's all BC. Were the ruling dates for Cambyses. C-A-M-B-Y-S-E-S. I should have gone to that map. Let me interrupt myself for a minute. If you look, we have the Seleucid Empire over here. The kingdom of Seleucus was the original general. The kingdom of Ptolemy was there. This was back in the 330s BC, after Alexander died. Lysimachus has part of Macedonia and part of Asia Minor, normally referred to as Thrace. And then the smaller little area up in the corner was Cassander or Antigonus. The kingdom of Antigonus II was also known as Cassander, I believe. So that gives you a little perspective of that. Let me see what other maps I have. Oh, I don't have a map. We'll stay with that one. That's Antiochus Epiphanes on a coin. So presumably it was sort of what he looked like, but I found that, faces on coins look remarkably similar back from those days. Okay. We'll get back to Antiochus, but let's stick with the map for right now. In fact, we're back in the time of the Persian Empire. So there were these three rulers, and Darius the First was the third, 522 to 486. The pseudo-Smerdis, S-M-E-R-D-I-S, was a pretender. He pretended to be Cambyses' younger brother, but he wasn't. And when that was figured out, then Darius killed him, and he became the king, Darius the First. Now, the other Darius, the one that Daniel is talking with, remember, is a Mede. This is a Darius who was a Persian. Thus, as a emperor, he was the first Persian emperor named Darius. And the fourth was Xerxes, who was the husband to Esther. Three more kings will arise, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all, and by his strength and his riches he will stir up all the realm of Greece. Xerxes is the one that tried to conquer Greece. He took an army of about 1 million men and I forget how many ships to try to conquer Greece, but he lost. The Greeks could outsail him. They understood that better. They could fight as good as he could. They just didn't have as many people. But they defeated him because he had to have ships to cross the Aegean Sea, and he lost his ships to the Greeks. And then in verse 3, 129 years later, so then, a mighty king, and the mighty king that would come after these great Persian kings, the mighty one that would be the fulfillment of that, was Alexander the Great. From 336 to 323 B.C., he will arise, who will rule with great dominion. And he was the next ruler in history that had a greater dominion than Xerxes, and do according to his will. He was unstoppable until his sudden death at age 33. He became the king of Macedon when I think he was 20, and then picked up where his father had left off. He was forging a convergence of the Greeks and the Macedonians into a powerful nation, and Alexander finished that work, and he really was pretty amazing in what he was able to do. And then in verse 4, when he, Alexander, had arisen, his kingdom will be broken up at his death in 323 at the height of his achievements. He was broken up, divided to the four winds of heaven, which we read in chapter 8, with the notable horns. But not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled. In other words, he had no heirs. It was his generals who weren't related to him, you know, by blood. His generals then took the empire. For his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these, because within a few years the empire ended up split among the four generals, Ptolemy, Seleucus, Cassander, and Lysimachus. It took several years for that all to shake out, but ultimately it did. Then in verse 5, the king of the south, which would be now Ptolemy the First, you know, again, P-T-O-L-E-M-Y, over Egypt, south of the Holy Land, shall become strong, and that was that would be the time of 323 to 285, as well as one of his princes, Seleucus the First, and he, referring now to Seleucus, shall gain power over him, over Ptolemy, and have dominion. And eventually that did happen. Seleucus eventually gained rule over greater Syria. And Seleucus's domain, his domain, or dominion, shall be a great dominion over most had been most of the Persian Empire and most of Alexander's empire. So the Seleucids were the largest of the inheritors of Alexander's empire. The question was, who was going to be dominant in the force? Because the Egyptian Ptolemies, the Ptolemaic kingdom, was very powerful too. And they had knockdown, drag-out battles over and over again as time went on. So we're having, in Daniel 11, all of these events are unfolding, and these detailed prophecies that Daniel was giving in the 500s B.C., they're starting to come to pass in the 300s B.C., and then we'll move into the 200s and then down into the 100s. So that this series of detailed prophecies are all unfolding just as Daniel was inspired to write it down. Now, from this point, the angel focuses on the two of the four divisions of Alexander's empire, and they, of course, would be the... Where did I put my pointer? Ah, there it is. They would be... Let's go to that other one. The kingdom of Seleucus and the kingdom of Ptolemy. And the reason is that Lysimachus's empire was overrun by the Seleucids. They dominated Asia Minor. At one point, they tried to make an incursion into Greece. That's a little bit later. We'll come to that. It didn't work very well because the Romans didn't like them doing that. And Rome was finally more powerful than they were. So we're going to focus mainly, most of the prophecy now talks just about these two until Rome comes into play. The Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Everybody following all this? Okay. It's a detailed prophecy. And if you could understand who the he's are, you know, he did this and then he did that and he went to his and he's. If you understand those, you'd be just fine. But that requires some historical background. And thankfully, there have been plenty of historians who've seen the correlations and they have reconstructed what I'm unfolding here for you. Verse 6, at the end of some years, that would be 252 B.C., 28 years after Seleucus the First's death, he ruled for a long time, they, the north and south, will join forces. For the daughter of the king of the south, her name was Berenice. Bernice is the variation of what we would use now as Bernice for a female name. Berenice will go to the king of the north. So Antiochus II made an arrangement or a peaceful arrangement in the New American Standard Bible that is a marriage to seal an alliance, which required Antiochus II to put away his former wife, Laodice. But she, Bernice, shall not retain the power of her authority or her position of power, as the New American Standard Bible says, and neither he, that is Antiochus II, nor his authority shall stand. But she, Berenice, shall be given up, and she was. She died. She was given up in death, with those who brought her, meaning her attendants, and with those who begot her father Ptolemy II, and with him who strengthened her in those times, and that would be Antiochus II. Antiochus was in the north, the Ptolemies are in the south. Now here's the story. When Berenice's father Ptolemy II died that particular year of 246 B.C., her father and her, let me see, I lost my place in my notes. Okay, Berenice and her father and her husband were all removed from power by death in 246. I missed a sentence in my notes. 246 B.C. When Berenice's father Ptolemy died that year, her husband Antiochus repudiated her and went back to his first wife, Laodice. See, he had the alliance with Ptolemy II. So Ptolemy II died down in Egypt. And so he just said, well, then the deal's off. And he says, I like that other chick better. So he got rid of Berenice as his wife and took Laodice back. And Laodice is how you'd spell that, L-A-O-D-I-C-E. But later that year, because, you know, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And Laodice had been scorned. Laodice, doubting Antiochus's faithfulness, I wonder why, and anxious to secure the throne for his and her son Seleucus II, she murdered her husband and had Berenice put to death as well. So the intrigues, the back and forth, is all prophesied there by Daniel. And when you lay down what God inspired Daniel to write into the historical record, bingo, bango, there it is. Verse 7, but a branch of her roots, the offspring of Berenice's parents, that is a sibling, actually her brother Ptolemy III, will arise in Ptolemy the Second's place, in his place, and shall come with an army. This was the next year, 245 B.C. After the enter the fortress, that would be Seleucia, the port of Syria's capital, Antioch, of the king of the north. So he would enter the fortress of the king of the north and deal with them, that is, avenge his sister's death and prevail. Bear in mind now that Ptolemy the Third was the brother to the dead Berenice. So he was upset. So then they had to have a war over it. And he, Ptolemy the Third, in verse 8, the first part, shall carry their gods captive to Egypt and their princes and their precious articles and silver and gold. And he did that. He took an immense amount of wealth back to Egypt, including 2,500 molten images and idolatrous vessels that the Persian emperor Cambyses had taken from Egypt in 526 B.C. So they'd been gone for a while. He brought them back. The second part of verse 8, and he, Ptolemy the Third again, shall continue more years than the king of the north, Seleucus the Second. Ptolemy ruled until his death in 221 B.C., which was 6 years after the death of Seleucus up in Syria. So they had this big war, and the Ptolemaic kingdom won, even though the Seleucids were larger. And in verse 9, and then the king of the north, actually just he, Seleucus the Second, shall come, so he makes an attempted attack or counterattack to the kingdom Egypt, to the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. He failed. You know, that was you got the attack to the north, and then the north attacks the south, but in this case, the north attacking the south didn't work. So in verse 9, and the king of the north, I read verse 9. Verse 10, however, this is the current king up in the north, Seleucus the Second, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces to avenge their father and their port and their fortress. And they did. And one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. And that was the one known as Antiochus the Third. Antiochus the Third is the father of Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes. So this Antiochus the Third is of significance for us here. Shall stir up strife, assemble a multitude of great forces, immense force. They went against Egypt to try to avenge their father and recover their port and the loot that had been taken. And Antiochus the Third shall certainly come and pass through, and he did that. He recovered his fortress, Seleucia, after 27 years. Took a while, but they did it. And he conquered the south into what was currently Egyptian territory as far as Gaza, which included Judea. Up to that time, If we look here, going up the coast from the Nile River, you see that the area where Israel is was under the Ptolemies almost all the time, up until 221 B.C. And that's when it was taken over by the king of the north, Antiochus the Third, got a hold of Judea. Then it became his province. And in verse 11, the king of the south, which is now another Ptolemy the Fourth, the son of Ptolemy the Third, shall be moved with rage and go out, and he did, with an army of 20,000 men, and fight with him, that is, the fight with the king of the north, who will muster a multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of Antiochus the Third's enemy. And so the Ptolemies conquered or defeated Antiochus's expeditionary force. And when the he here in the first part of verse 12 is Ptolemy the Fourth. So remember, if you can keep track of the he's, you can follow this. When Ptolemy the Fourth had taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up and he will cast down tens of thousands. And that's what they did. Ptolemy the Fourth's army killed tens of thousands of Syrian troops and he re-annexed Judea to Egypt. So Judea got taken from the Ptolemies and went to the king of the north, and then the king of the north lost it in a battle, and so the king of the south controlled them again. And And then after Ptolemy the Fourth died in 204, he left his throne to his infant son, Ptolemy the Fifth. And Antiochus assembled a great army and attacked Egypt in Antiochus the Third in 201 BC. So about 201 BC it goes back. Now in those times, many, Antiochus the Third having made an alliance with Philip of Macedon, shall come against the king of the south. So he got some allies, and violent men of yore, meaning Daniel's people, the Jews, and so there were some of the Jews that fought on behalf of Antiochus the Third, will exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they'll fail. And so they did. So in verse 15, the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city. He defeated Sidon. And if you remember where Sidon was, do we have a picture? See where Phoenicia is? Damascus and then Phoenicia. Almost due west of Damascus would be Tyre and Sidon, just a little bit north and a little bit south, or over on the coast. So they came and they took Sidon. It was still a very important port for the king of the north. And the forces of the south under the fifth Ptolemy shall not withstand him. So his troops, Ptolemy the Fifth, shall have no strength to resist. But in verse 16, he, Antiochus the Third again, who comes against him, meaning Ptolemy the Fifth, shall do according to Antiochus the Third's own will. No one will stand against him. And he shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. So, following the Battle of Panium in 198 BC, Antiochus III wrested control of Judea from Egypt again. So back, it's like a tennis ball. The Jews are going back and forth between king of the south and the king of the north. And in a sense, the final part of the match is going to come in the end of the age, because we have the king of the north and the king of the south coming up again. And how much? We stop to eat at noon? Okay, then we need to stop and eat. Where did I leave off? Verse 16. All right. In the sermon, I will accelerate through chapter 11, and then we will go back to chapter 10. So, Matthew, would you just ask a blessing on the lunch for us, please? If you'll all rise.